You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 298.
On today's show, we shared the live TAS episode we recorded in February about the prehistory of Mexico.
Let's dig a little deeper. Tacos. You just want to know about tacos. We start with it.
Okay, welcome to the Archaeology Show. Woo! You need your microphone.
Hello. I've done this before. The live show?
The live show.
Yeah.
And, okay, so for anybody on Discord, thank you for joining us. For all of our live audience, thank you for joining us. This is the first time we've actually had a live audience ever, so... Woo! Yeah.
Yes, it is. So be kind.
Yeah,
be kind.
Yeah. So here's the deal. Normally we do this show in three segments and we cover news articles that are relevant to now. You know, we usually look at something within the last week or two and we just talk about it from an archaeological perspective. This week we're covering Mexico prehistory because we're down here in sunny, beautiful Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
With all our friends. And the way this goes with the live show, just for anybody who's wanting to know this, we do have a camera facing out here, but actually none of this is going to be on YouTube or anything like that. It actually, for our members, our Discord is actually free, so anybody who joins on our Discord server can watch this for free anytime we have a live event with the Archaeology Podcast Network. And we're going to be doing live shows for all of our podcasts. We've got a bunch of different podcasts on the APN. Mm-hmm. Every month
is
going to be a new live recording.
Yes.
And we're going to be doing other live events and things like that, too. So,
yes.
We're going to be putting that out on our socials. Instagram is ArcPodNet. All the places it's ArcPodNet for knowing where those live events come out. And then also, this recording, which is why we're recording this and speaking into these microphones, will be available at arcpodnet.com/members. Incidentally, it's $7.99 a month or $76 a year to become a member of the APN. And that just helps us pay the fees and keep the lights on, basically. Doesn't really do a whole lot aside from that. But we do appreciate it. So, but all of our live events are available to members.
Yes.
So, okay. So if you guys got any questions, please just shout them out. Stop us. We don't know everything.
No, we don't.
But we know some things.
We have...
Based on what you said the other day.
Well, you know, that's not what I tell her.
We will pretend like we know the answer,
That's right. And then anybody on Discord, we're trying to monitor that while we monitor this at the same time. So please let me know if you've got any questions out there as well.
Yep.
All right.
So... Are you ready to launch in?
Let's just do this.
Okay, so we're all here in Mexico, and it's a beautiful country, and it has a rich and amazing prehistory.
Yep.
But what we're really all here for is...
Where do tacos come
from? Tacos. So we thought we would begin our little conversation, our talk here with the history of the taco, which is not what you would expect,
Not what
right?
you'd expect.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm just going to side chat this one because I love Cornish pasties.
Uh-huh.
And if you've ever had a Cornish pasty, I mean, they're kind of related to, what is it, like empanadas?
Yeah, kind of similar to empanadas, yeah.
Almost related to like pierogies even, you know, but not really because you got to like, pierogies are not that easy to eat in your hand.
It's like a shell stuffed with stuff.
Stuffed
right?
with stuff.
Yeah, lots of different things. Yeah.
Cornish pasties, incidentally, everybody down here, you go up to... Cottonwood or go up to Jerome. There's a Cornish pasty place up in Jerome, Arizona.
Best Cornish pasties I've ever had.
Yeah.
But just go and try them. Yeah. They're amazing.
And in a month, we're going to actually be in Cornwall in England where the Cornish pasty was invented.
So we will certainly
have
try them there.
Decent ones there. But anyway, those were invented for miners, coal miners, basically, so they could take handheld food into mines with them, right? It was like basically a lunchbox. It was all kinds of stuff inside of a pastry so they could take. And Mexicans did the same thing, basically, silver mines back in the 18th century.
Yep.
And
so there were pieces of paper wrapped around gunpowder that were inserted into holes carved in the rock face. That's what they used to blow up or whatever and get access to the silver. It was silver mining, right?
Yeah. And they like, well, we have tortillas that look a lot like this paper.
Yeah.
So we could put some stuff inside that and take it down into the mine and have a nice, quick, easy lunch.
So they...
Don't confuse the two.
Do not confuse the two. So. But yeah, they got the idea from these papers that were wrapped around their explosive. So, and then they just started stuffing them with various things. And we have this amazing assortment of different foods and meats and stuff now today. But that is how the taco started.
That's basically it.
Yeah.
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 So.
All that silver mining too, just like a little bit more history, was basically... It was instigated by the Spanish, I think, right? And it was a way for them to, you know, just extract as much money out of this area as well. So a little bit of colonialism going on in that as well. So, you know.
Well, and it is it is a little bit crazy, too, because honestly, a lot of us come down here and we're like, we need tacos because Mexico.
Yeah.
But like tacos were not really invented, by indigenous Mexicans necessarily because of them, because of colonialism.
They certainly ate them, but it's because they were kind of being forced to work in the mines and, you know, dig up all the riches that were getting sent back to Spain or used to build up the Spanish colonial areas of Mexico. So, yeah.
And actually, we all know about tacos because of, I hate to say it, Taco Bell.
What? No way.
I'm serious. I didn't put that in the notes. I didn't put that in the notes, but it's not. I wanted that to be a little bit of a surprise, though, because there was actually, they called them chili girls or something like that. But there was these women would come up from Mexico and they had basically food carts in like San Antonio and southern parts of Texas. And apparently you could get basically what they were calling a taco at the time and other Gringo stuff tacos. From these girls. And And people went down there and they just loved it. And it was this novelty thing because Mexico was a dangerous place back then as well. And in those areas. And it was a way to experience Mexico for some people and you know, the food anyway, and to get this. And then around the 1940s, somebody patented like the taco shell. And the I forget his first name, but Bell is the last name of the guy who started Taco Bell. And
so it was a white guy who...
Well,
took the Mexican foods and commercialized it across. That sounds well, totally correct.
He claimed to have invented it. He claimed to have patented the hard shell taco, but the guy who did the research on this, the hard shell taco, because Mexico wasn't actually doing hard shells. They were doing soft shells. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he claimed to have invented the hard shell taco, but the patent actually went back 10 years before he franchised and started Taco Bell. But all he did was... He was one of the early franchisers, right? Like McDonald's and other stuff. So, and the franchising of Taco Bell is why tacos took off in America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So, and now we're all looking. The podcast is over. Let's go get tacos. So.
I don't think the taco carts are open yet.
Oh, they're not.
It's a little early for them here, I think.
It's about 8 hours too early, probably.
Yeah.
breakfast tacos.
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, right. So that's tacos.
We thought that would be fun. Out of the way because we knew people just be waiting for it.
Yeah,
so,
obviously.
Yeah, let's keep going.
So we also wanted to like just do like a basic overview prehistory of Mexico. And I started doing the research. I did most of the research for this part. And I was like, well, we're here, you know, at the tip of the Gulf of California, right? And there's all these amazing Mexican civilizations. But none of them were up here. Now, they definitely influenced. There was always trade that was happening and stuff like that. But they didn't actually come this far north. The groups of people that were here were actually much more influenced by the larger cultures that were up in Arizona, that were to the east in northern Mexico and southern Texas, and then also to the west in southern Arizona. So interesting that there... You know, the indigenous peoples to this continent, they didn't know about borders, obviously. The Mexican border was not a thing to them. But you do get these, like, geographic borders. And the Sonoran Desert, which is what we're technically part of here, was a big, like, geographic separator for the people here. So that's why you get that split. But that being said, I really still thought it would be kind of cool to go through the big cultures in Mexico. And we can talk about those. So,
that's right.
Yeah.
But just like... pretty much everything else in North America, this land was, according to doctrine and current theories, which are always up for debate, people settled North and South America through the Beringia land bridge, crossing from Siberia over to Alaska and down approximately 12 to 14, 15,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and then basically settled all the way down. Now that, I say, is in a little bit of dispute because there are sites, one we just recently talked about, that's in Canada, actually, Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. That is a well-developed, not a campsite, but a well-developed habitation site that dates back to about 14,000 years ago, mm-hmm. which if you're a well-developed site in that area, doesn't mean we're passing through. It means you were chilling for a while.
And you didn't roll up 14,000 years ago and establish it. Like, there was some lead up to get to that point. So people were certainly there earlier.
Yeah. Anytime you've got something like that, it means they were there for a long time, had knowledge of the land, knew how to eat there, knew how to live there. Mm-hmm. You don't just show up and start a town.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and then there's also the footprints New Mexico and White Sands. I don't know if anybody's heard about that. We've talked about it a ton on the podcast because I think it's one of the coolest Paleo-Indian sites that has come up recently, and it's basically these footprints that they found, I guess they're fossilized?
Yeah,
they're like fossilized into the sand in White Sands National Park or Monument, whichever one it is. And they found like pollen pressed between the layers of the fossilized sand stuff that they can date to like 20 to 24,000 years ago range, which is like way old, right? And that's not that far from here, not to an indigenous group that was nomadic and moving around a lot. So you have to imagine that people were here probably further back in time than the standard has been in the past. So the
question is, just to talk about that for briefly a second here, there isn't really a question, I don't think, anymore of were there multiple migrations into North and South America. It seems almost unequivocally there was. And mm-hmm. could they have come by sea? Could they have come through following kelp down the coast? Because all of North America was covered in ice mm-hmm. For a long period of time, for almost 15,000 years. Could they have been doing it over the last possibly 100,000 years, right? Now, the big question is, though,
that's a lot of years.
That's a lot of years.
That's maybe too many years.
Maybe too many. But there were people, humans, in Europe for 200,000 years. So it's not completely inconceivable, right?
It's not.
So the bigger question is, though, which one stuck?
Yeah.
Did people get to this half of the world and then not make it, die out, environmental reasons, things like that? Or did some of them make it through all this with small declining populations and then just kind of like barely hang on and then build back up? Or
yeah,
it's, or what?
There's always the question. And we are still filling in that picture of the peopling of the Americas. And it's the question that is constantly, like, researchers are constantly arguing over it. Like the footprints I was talking about, there are plenty of people who are like, nope, that's not real. It's not. They're not. Oh, yeah. They're not human. Some people say they're not human. Others are like, nope, those dates, there's stuff going on with those dates. We don't buy it. So like, but that's always how it is when the standard is somebody's trying to change it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's fine. Like, maybe we will find out that they're not as good of a date as we thought they were. But you have to keep looking and you have to keep trying because, you know, otherwise you get stuck in this place where like we got here 10,000 years ago and that's that.
Yeah.
Full stop. It's just not the way it is anymore. Yeah. So not the accepted theory.
More Mexico.
Okay, back to Mexico, yeah. That being said, there is evidence for indigenous populations, you know, 10,000 years ago plus in Mexico, like you would expect, probably even further back. Those super old groups were nomadic hunter-gatherers. They moved with the seasons. They were following game. They were hunting. They were hunting mammoths. They were hunting bison, other animals, deer, all that kind of stuff. That was the lifestyle back then. It was very much on the move, following the animals, hunting, and also following like the types of foods that they could gather as well. But they started to sort of come together and become like, you know, more organized societies by about 5000 BCE. And that's when we start seeing evidence they were cultivating maize or corn. And other veggies, too, like chili peppers, beans, squashes. But those came along a little later. I think maize was the first one, and it was the biggest one. And it still is. I mean, corn is everywhere down here. It's in all the foods, tortillas, all of that. So it just makes sense. It's a staple crop in this area for these people. By 2300 BCE, so now we're talking like 4,000-ish years ago, they began to make pottery. And when you see pottery come into play, that is because people have the skills. They have the place. They can live in one place. They collect all the ingredients. They have the ability to make pottery. So they're staying in one area, right? So that's when people start to, you know, really come together, build these societies, these groups. And that's when you're going to start seeing the cultures that we all know, the different peoples that made the monumental architecture.
Question.
Yes.
Hand him the microphone.
Do you know of any studies that have been done that compared the populations and type of people on this side compared to the other side of the Baja? Like, did people go down the Baja and go, oh crap, dead end, and just stay? Or, you know, it would be neat to see, you know, where, because this is not a swimmable body of water
for
the average person. So I wonder how different the civilizations were as it just across the water.
I don't know if they've been compared, honestly. I didn't come across anything like that when I was doing research. But what I did see is that the peoples that occupied the Baja tended to get there later. At least from the evidence that we have now. There's not as much evidence for the super old occupations. Not like you see in mainland Mexico and up into North America as well. So, yeah.
Also, be cautious saying things like, you know, not a swimmable body of water and stuff like that. Yeah. Because 4,000 years ago, and well, even today, right? I mean, your own personal biases, like, it's not a swimmable body of water for me, but it is for some people, right?
Well, maybe not swimmable, but boatable.
Well,
and
boatable,
they the average person. Yeah.
But even so, like, you know, if you don't have Netflix and you don't have an RV and you don't have other stuff, like, your tolerances for certain things and just like your normal average everyday life is a completely different existence than what it is now. You know what I mean?
And like I said, these people were nomadic, these ones from, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. So they could potentially have started up here and just slowly, slowly, slowly work their way down the coast. They might have even gone around the tip of Baja and then back up into California. Like, I don't know if we necessarily have evidence for that, but we do know that people followed the coastlines. So they potentially could have done that. And then that would have been a mixing of people between mainland and Baja too, if that did happen.
A note on pottery, though. One of the reasons that that does indicate a more sedentary lifestyle is because of the just the sheer engineering requirements for making pottery,
right?
The skills, but also you have to fire pottery typically. I mean, there's other ways to do it, but you typically have to fire it, which means you have to have some sort of a kiln or high temperature fire to do that. And, you know, you can't just do that from a campsite typically. I mean, yeah.
Definitely exactly. Not from an RV. Although I have dyed yarn in my RV.
Yeah, well.
It went all right.
Yeah. But it just takes some gear that you're not just like hauling around. So either you're coming to this area, they had things called seasonal rounds in a lot of places, maybe not down here because there aren't too many seasons, but in places where there are seasons, they would have seasonal rounds where they would say, you know, here's their summer camp, here's their winter camp, you know, basically like when we get to 60, 70 years old, we have seasonal rounds, right?
That's true.
Snowbirds.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, they would, you know, go to where following the game or also going to where the seasons are more conducive to them just living outside without basically, you know, shelter. That's really good. So, is there a question on Discord? Yeah. But while you're reading that. So anyway, pottery does have that indicator. Now, it doesn't mean they didn't travel with pottery either, right? They would definitely travel with pottery because some of the stuff was really robust and, you know, they just stack it up and hang it off and travel around with it, right? Didn't mean they weren't still moving around with that stuff. Because we do find, you know, broken bits of pottery and stuff like that sometimes, just like out in the desert when we've done survey up in Nevada, you know, away from, say, a campsite or a settlement or something like that. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, the comment on Discord is studies on shared iconography in Lower Pecos rock art and Aztec creation stuff. It's hard to see the screen because of the sun. Starting to present the idea of tracking the evolution of a common ideological universe going into or coming from Central America. And that's something I have to talk about when we get to the archaeology of Puerto Peñasco in the area that we're in right now. But yeah, there definitely is like shared knowledge, shared resources, shared information that you can track from Central America all the way up into North America. So the people might have been geographically separated, but they were still making contact with each other.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's blitz through the great cultures of Mexico real quick. This is going to be so fast. It won't be all of them, but it will be some of the big ones. And maybe, like, if you're ever exploring in mainland Mexico, these are the types of places that you might want to go and see or figure out what the big sites are and go and see them. So generally speaking, the oldest culture that was doing the monumental stuff is the Olmecs. And they were on the Gulf Coast near Veracruz from approximately 1200 BCE to 600 BCE. And they are the ones that are known for those big stone heads. So when you see those are the Olmecs, and they are also the oldest. From there, there's kind of a power vacuum once they sort of declined, and we get two that rise up in their place. That's the Teotihuacan, which are right outside of Mexico City, and they flourish from 300 BCE to around 700 CE, and that's that big, huge complex with, like, the Avenue of the Dead, I think it's called, and then the big Temple of the Sun and the Temple of the Moon and all, like, the huge city complex that's right outside of Mexico City. Always wanted to go there. That's definitely on my bucket list to go and check it out. Looks so, so cool.
We'll see that one go to the next Formula One race there.
Sure. It's the largest pre-Columbian city in the Americas, with the population estimates. I saw up to 200,000 people at the height. Like, that's huge. For comparison, they said that Florence in Italy at the same time only had 100,000 people. So a lot of people like to sort of not downplay the cities in the Americas because they weren't as technologically advanced as what was going on in Europe. But they were still huge, and they still had tons of people, you know? So it's just, the places are just so cool, and they should not be forgotten.
Real quick, that reminds me, we've done a couple episodes. We need to get back to this, because we've done a couple episodes, because I'm fascinated by that concept of what was happening in one part of the world and what was happening in another part of the world, right? And we call it timelines episodes. Yeah. So I pick what I call an anchor event that everybody knows. It's like, you know, oh, okay, so... I don't know.
Well, Teotihuacan would be a great one. I don't think we've done them, but
no.
Yeah, that was about 2,000 years ago. So it's like, what's going on in other places around the world at the same time?
Yeah, and places that you might not even be thinking about, right?
Yeah,
Because
happening in China when Teotihuacan is at its height? I don't know. That would be such a cool thing to find out.
Yeah, exactly. What's happening in Africa? What's happening in Australia?
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's the kind of stuff we like to learn.
Yeah, I like those kinds of things.
Okay, so simultaneously, maybe perhaps a little bit after Teotihuacan, the Mayans are also thriving in southern Mexico, particularly in the Yucatan Peninsula. And they were from about 250 BCE to 900 CE, which doesn't seem as long as it should be, because they're such a, like, iconic, I don't know, group of people that everybody's heard of, and their calendar and their language and everything is still, like, part of Mexican culture today. And there are people who still have Mayan descent today, but really the height of their civilization was, you know, less than 1,000 years. And the thing is that even, and this is where archaeology is kind of crazy sometimes, like, people always say, oh, it goes from this year to this year, and then they were gone. They weren't gone. Never are the people gone. They don't go anywhere. They just get, you know, absorbed into a new ruling power, or maybe there's just fewer of them. Maybe the resources are less and there's just less people, so therefore they have less power. You know, like, there's a lot of reasons, but the people don't go anywhere. And they contribute their brains and their ideas to the future people that come into the area. So never, I hate the word collapse. I hate the word, I even kind of hate the word decline, although decline is kind of accurate, I suppose.
Well, sometimes they culturally decline in one area, but advance in another, right? So archaeologically speaking, they are gone from the archaeological record in one sense, but advance in another sense, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yes, keep that in mind. People are still around. But the Mayans were brilliant. We know this. They created a writing system, a calendar, monumental architecture like Chichen Itza and Tikal, and among others. So another really great place. And Chichen Itza is very accessible if you don't want to go, like, into crazy, you know, Mexico that is maybe unsafe. But you can get to Chichen Itza from Cancun pretty easily. We did it in a day trip when we went to Cancun. So it's certainly worth it. And there's that other one, too, the other big site that's right near
Tulum.
Cancun. Yeah, Tulum is also another really cool one. We didn't get to go to that one, but another great one. Very accessible if you're on vacation in these areas anyway. I always like to encourage the nerdy trips when you're on vacation. Take a day off of, you know, partying and go see the nerdy stuff. That's what we do anyway. Okay, so with the decline of Teotihuacan in the Mexico City area, that was around 700 CE, the Toltecs emerged in central Mexico. They would be the next great culture. And these guys were cool. They do have their sites, their monumental architecture and all that. But the main thing they did that was really awesome was that they established trade routes all the way north and south. And that was kind of what one of the people in the Discord server was saying, is that these people were in communication with each other. And there's a lot of turquoise, I guess, in the, like, central Mexico area. And they were trading it all the way up into Chaco Canyon. Canyon, which is in New Mexico, at Puebla Bonita, you can see turquoise that is, it's very easy to source those types of minerals, and they can see that it came from Central Mexico.
Yeah.
So those people were talking to each other, and they were trading, and they were sharing knowledge and goods and resources and stuff between them. So they did all have influence on each other, even if they weren't, you know, part of the same culture.
Right.
Okay, and then finally, the last one we'll just touch on quickly is the Aztecs. Of course, you have to talk about the Aztecs. They were the last great power here before the Spanish came, and they did rise to power in central Mexico, also in the Mexico City area, around 1300. And they were another interesting group because they were all about money. They were all about the economics. They just wanted to be the richest empire they possibly could. They conquered everybody around them that they could, but they didn't necessarily squash those people out. They wanted them to continue thriving and making money so then they could tax them and take that money. So that's how the Aztecs operated, and that's what they were doing when the Spanish arrived. And then the Spanish just sort of like hooked into that system and continued with the taking of all the money.
The Aztecs were like, we have tremendous laws. we want you guys to just flourish and but God, we're gonna take all your stuff.
Okay, yeah. Their capital was Tenochtitlan, which is present-day Mexico City. Mexico City is basically right on top of it. So, yeah, they were super rich by the time the Spanish arrived. It took the Spanish 2 years to decimated them. And all of those riches started getting funneled back to the Spanish Empire. And like we talked about with tacos, they continued to extract all those riches up until, like, I didn't go into all the history of the Mexican Revolution and everything, but there has been multiple revolutions in Mexico until they were finally gained their independence in the 1800s sometime. So, yeah. Yay, colonialism! No.
No.
I don't mean that. That's jokes. So, yeah, that's, like, your blitz history of, like, all the big, you know, cultures of Mexico. There's many other small ones, and they all have like really distinct and interesting flavors that they contributed to, you know, what Mexico is today. So it's really cool. There's so many cool sights to see in this country. Like, I love coming here to Puerto Peñasco, but I want to, like, I don't know, I just want to go into Mexico and see all the cool things.
So, yeah, continuing on here. Well,
any questions? That was like questions? A blitz, like, yeah. Here are all of the things in order.
See anything else here?
Go see them all. I want to see the big heads too. The colossal heads. That would be awesome.
That's right.
Yeah.
A lot of big heads here. All right. So, wouldn't they like to know? All right. I wore the wrong sunglasses.
Yeah, you did. I can hear your notifications hold on a second. Through your sunglasses.
Hey, Meta, pause notifications. I mean, all the people leaving these messages in this group are sitting here. So. All right. So now let's talk about this area a little bit more. Something to remember while there were people living here, which I don't know, when you read these notes and you think about this stuff, archaeologists and geologists like to write in terms that make it seem like people were watching this happen, but they weren't. But
yeah.
The Gulf of California here was, and a lot of bodies of water, the coastlines of North America, to some extent the coastlines of South America, were in pretty huge flux, but over the course of thousands of years because of the melting glaciers, right? As the glaciers covering much of Canada and mm-hmm. and down into the northern United States were melting, that water had to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And it was going right back into the sea and filling it up.
Which is super interesting because we don't really see evidence of people here until the Gulf settles down, like around 6,000 years ago. Yeah. But they were probably here. It's just that they're underwater now. Like that evidence of the people that were here doing stuff maybe 10,000 years ago, who knows? It's underwater. So, I mean, there could be evidence if some underwater archaeologists wanted to go hunting for it. But like without knowing where to go and what to look for, like I feel like that would be a big task right there.
Yeah. Incidentally, it's really cool. Underwater archaeology is a fascinating discipline.
Yeah.
If you're into, but you got to get into not only scuba, but you got to also get into archaeology. And it's expensive because
it's very expensive.
You know, you got to be able to go down and draw and things like that, and you can only go down for so long, as these guys know.
Yeah.
And only so many times a day as well, right? Yeah. That's why it's such an expensive endeavor to do.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is, in certain places, like, sure, there's shipwrecks. I just did an interview that's coming out Monday with this lady that worked with, just side chat here, Diving with a Purpose, which... fascinating story. Diving with a Purpose, they do other stuff, but for the last 20 years or so, they've been specifically interested in diving shipwrecks for slave ships that went down. Mm-hmm. Over 1.8 million slaves died in transit.
Wow.
That's just died in transit.
Yeah.
So
it's crazy.
Check that out Monday. But anyway, yeah. diving. The cool thing about finding sites, though, shipwrecks are hard to find unless they're well documented. And some of those are because there was money involved. But shipwrecks are hard to find. But other sites, when you're talking about these kinds of sites, They're actually kind of easy to find sometimes. Mm. Some of them are, because if you look at water outflows like rivers and stuff, people like to camp along rivers.
Yeah.
And you can see where ancient river channels are even under the water today, right? Mm-hmm. And you look around the Gulf of Mexico and you can see, like, all around like Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, Where current rivers are coming out, people are actually doing active studies, because when the Gulf of Mexico was a lot smaller and those rivers continued further out, there are sites that they've found, Paleo-Indian sites dating back 12,000-14,000 years, mm-hmm, under the water, still there. And under San Francisco Bay, that didn't used to be a bay, that was a meadow, and There were people living there.
Yep.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, water's a resource, right, that people need, and so they would congregate near it, and water lines change. So that's how that happens. But but it's particularly cool in this area, though, because let me find my note here. Well, just let me get into it. So in 1997, a group of Mexican and American researchers called the Puerto Peñasco Archaeology and Paleo Environment Project, they worked together to document over 60 shell middens. Now, shell midden, you might wonder, is basically a trash pit. So, and archaeologists love trash pits. So basically, people would show up to the coast and, or they lived here. We'll get to why we're not super sure about that in a second. But they were obviously partaking of the marine resources that were here. And shells, you know, when you think about it, you produce a lot of shell when you are partaking of those resources. And then they just would get piled up and become a big old trash pit. And they usually put them in, you know, one space, obviously away from wherever they were camping or living. And that's how you end up with these shell middens. And they would also be full of other trash, too, that they're getting rid of. Broken pottery, broken projectile points or arrowheads. And the flakes that are created when you make a projectile point, that's also trash, right? So all that would be found together in this shell midden. So that's what they were finding. And it's really cool because there's actually one, I don't know if I'm pointing the right direction. Is that east? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's east, over there. There's one over there on the other side of town. And they excavated a big shell midden that was over there. And then there was four more that they excavated that were that direction, to the west, over on the one of the, there's a little bay over there, a bahia something, I can't remember what it's called. But that's where a river would have come out at some point. So that's why there's four of them over there that were excavated. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what he was talking about with the river. Yeah. So they did the actual excavation work. It was a long time. They did a lot of work. They started in 1997, but they didn't actually publish this research until 2018. It's academic life for you. It just takes a long time to get everything together and to do all the research. And they were probably working on tight time frames as far as the excavations were going. And it wasn't just excavation, too. They were fully mapping these things, like fully documenting. Because, you know, our excavation is a destructive science, right? So once it's gone, it's gone. So they had to fully map and document every single thing as they were doing the excavation. So anyway, it took a long time. But they found pottery fragments, like I was saying, that are associated with the Hohokam in southern Arizona. And that would be the culture that built the Casa Grande ruins that are kind of outside of Phoenix, I think, is where That national monument is. And then also the Patayan in southwestern Arizona and the Trincheras in Mexico. Apologies if I pronounced any of that wrong. So the pottery is coming from these places that are north and east and west. So it can represent a couple different things, right? Like there's two possibilities.
So a little bit of a talk about mittens here. We were talking about this in the clam last night. And for people on Discord over in the in Europe there, a clam is a place where we have academic discussions here. In,
while drinking an assortment of adult beverages. Yep,
that's what a clam is. Look it up. Anyway. Anyway, we were actually talking about this a little bit last night. But I have a little bit of a hard time with mittens sometimes, and archaeology in general, to be honest with you, because we write up everything we know generally about past cultures based on what they left behind, right? Mm-hmm. And what they left behind often is either A, what they discarded that they didn't use, or what was trash, or it's not often what they were actually using at the time. I mean, sometimes we do find fully formed things that they created, like projectile points, arrowheads, spear mm-hmm. points, things like that, especially when they're found inside of animals still, or people for that matter. And sometimes we find whole pots and stuff like that, and all that's really cool, right? But a lot of times we do just find fragments of things that are the remains of constructing something else, mm-hmm. or it's just something that broke and we don't know, we don't have the full picture, and we have to sort of try to construct a picture based on that, and it's really difficult.
It is, and you're always being influenced by your modern biases too, because you might see one thing and think, well, this is how I would use it, or this is what I would do with it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the people that created that thing would have used it that way. So it's really hard to take your own biases out of it, and it's why the world of archaeology has been evolving. This is a much bigger topic that we do not need to go into. But like for the last 100 years, the interpretations of archaeology have been evolving to remove bias as much as possible. Although it does still sneak in there, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. All the time. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to remove your own biases in pretty much every aspect of your life.
You don't even think about it.
Yeah.
And you're just doing it. And I'm not even sure it's a bad thing, because we are humans, right? And we're studying other humans. It's not like that's bad. It's just that you have to be aware of it so that you can remove it as much as possible.
Yeah.
Okay, so where were we?
Keep going.
Yeah, shell middens. So yeah, that was super cool. And just for everybody here, the reason all that work got done is because of the expansion of Puerto Peñasco back in the like early 2000s, essentially. So this was work that was being done ahead. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that these sites that they excavated, at least the one that's that direction, have been covered by buildings now. And they're lost. And the other stuff that they documented, if it was in the way of a building, it's just gone now. So the work they did was really great. And you don't get to go back and do it again. Like, you know, you can't stop the march of progress. And they certainly weren't going to with the town. So that is what it is. But I think they did get some good information on where those people were coming from, or what the people were doing here. And like I was saying, there are two possibilities. So these shell middens, they were either created by people who were harvesting the shells, people who lived in this area, who were harvesting the shells and taking them and trading them with these inland groups, the Hohokam and the others that are north of them. And we know this because the shells that you get here on this coast are found at those sites up into the Americas, or into the United States. So we know that they were definitely trading those shells that direction. But what we don't know is who was doing it. So it was either the people who lived here and they were just doing the trading, or those groups, the Hohokam, the Trincheras, and the other one, they were sending people to the coast saying, we need shells, we need this resource, we need that resource. You group of, you know, envoys or whatever you want to call them, go to the coast and get these things and bring them back to us. It could have been either one. And they haven't published any research on this since 2018. So I don't know if a conclusion has been settled on based on the artifacts that they found. But from what I can tell, they still don't really know which one of those things it is. So I thought that was cool. Archaeology is so great, but it's like, it almost like raises more questions than answers sometimes too. And this is a really good example of that.
Yeah.
I don't know that it matters though. I think both options are really cool. Whether the people lived here seasonally and traded north, or people from the north sent people south to get these things, it doesn't really matter. It's just, they knew that this resource was here and they were coming to use it because, you know, there's the wildlife here is so, the marine life is so like varied and vibrant here. It was just worth it to them to come and get those resources.
Okay, so one of the things we definitely wanted to cover, and just I'm going to preface this by, if you want to know more, we have another podcast on the APN called the Rock Art Podcast, and I can direct you to some of the episodes, but we proudly recorded I don't know, at least 4 or 5 episodes on just this topic with the people who were at the time actually running tours down to this place. But we'll get to there. But there's so much more information on this. But over in the Baja, let me get down to your notes here. It's called the... first off, the difference between a pictograph and a petroglyph. Does anybody know that? Go ahead. You don't need the mic.
It's fine.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
Pictographs are painted. Mm-hmm. That's right. Petroglyphs.
Think picture with that one. Yeah.
Petroglyphs are etched, carved, pecked, anything that, you know.
Remove stone from the surface of the.
Keep in mind, petroglyphs can also be painted.
They can be a combination.
Additionally, yes. But they're still just called petroglyphs.
Yeah.
Right. So, but they often do have paint inside of the lines, right? Mm-hmm. They would have painted inside of them. So, but pictographs are just painted. They're murals. They're painted on the wall or something like that. But these are pictographs. There are petroglyphs there, but the great mural.
The pictographs are what are so stunning.
Yeah. It's called the Sierra de San Francisco. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, or as Rachel wrote, World Heritage Site.
Yeah.
Yep.
Whoops.
Yep. But they're on the Baja Peninsula. They're extremely well preserved because of the dry climate and the massive inaccessibility.
Yes.
There is no way to get to these things.
No way at all.
They're on the walls and roofs of this this massive rock shelter type of area.
I saw the coolest picture of an archaeologist basically laying on his back looking up at an overhang of a cave or a rock shelter, and it was just paintings all the way across and these vibrant colors. So it's just a really, really cool area.
Yeah. Shh. just open it. they're brightly painted in red, black, white, and yellow. Seriously, if you've got a phone and you want to look it up, Sierra de San Francisco.
That's the larger area, and there's a bunch of sites just within that.
Rock paintings on the Baja. It's super cool.
Yeah.
Google it right now. There are human figures. They can be small or life-size. There's animals that represent deer, mountain sheep, rabbits, birds, fish. Incidentally, it's almost impossible to date rock art.
Yeah.
It's easier to date pictographs because some of the pigments can actually be dated because they're organic.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the ways you can actually date rock art is by the animals represented. Because if those animals are extinct now, and you know when they went extinct, you're like, well, the rock art has to date to at least then.
Yeah.
Or there's cultural knowledge and they were painting that, but chances are they weren't.
Yeah.
Chances are they were painting something they saw, right? So if they're painting something they saw and it no longer exists,
It's got to be at least
that
so old.
Right.
Yeah.
So you get into rock art, especially in the Southwest and things like that, that are painting people on cavalry horses and soldiers and mm-hmm. things like that. And you're like, okay, well, we know when they made those.
Mm-hmm.
So, or at least we hope. And then there's, of course, aliens and spaceships. It's all crazy.
Oh, God.
When did that happen?
No.
That's not true.
No.
Yeah.
Someday you'll have this podcast without talking about aliens. That day is not today.
many of the animals also have arrows sticking out of them because a lot of rock art was used as what some people just generically refer to as hunting magic. So it's mm-hmm. Trying to call into existence the mm-hmm. hunt that you want to happen sort of thing. But like we said here, pictographs are hard to date. But there was... In this case, there was a wooden peg found in a crevice down there, and that dated from, because you can date wood generally.
You can date wood, yeah.
And that was dated from 530 plus or minus 80 years, or sometime between 1352 and 1512.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean when the paintings were made.
No, that's not super long ago, but...
Yeah.
And also, they know that there are Spanish... there were Spanish people there. So conquistadors and various other guys were there. So
they pretty much made it everywhere.
Here. Yeah, they did. So it could have been from them. That's the thing. So we do this thing called relative dating, right? When you can't date the thing itself, which rock, although there are methods that are coming along with rock too, but relative dating is you date the things around it. But the problem with rock art is that they're not fixed to the rock art. So yes, there's a wooden peg there, but you don't know when that wooden peg got there. There might be arrowheads, projectile points, there could be pottery, all that could be there, but you don't know if the people that painted it put that pottery there or if it was somebody, 100 years later or 1,000 years later. So that's the hard part with dating this stuff. And you really just have to go with the most accurate way you can.
Somebody put a picture up on Discord from there.
Yeah. Honestly, I have some pictures on my computer, which I can show everybody here once we're done recording.
We'll post some stuff in the Mexico chat.
Yeah, they're stunning. I don't think we've ever seen rock art like this anywhere else that we've been.
We've seen some pretty cool rock art.
But the colors are amazing. And they do red and black, white and yellow. And like, for some reason, the human figures that are like 8 feet tall, they're much larger than human size, and they would split them down the middle. Stop it. They would split them down the middle, and half of them would be red and the other half would be black. And it's like, what could that possibly mean? Who knows? I don't know. And with and then with animals, they would split them horizontally and one half would be red and the other half would be black. What does that mean? I don't know, but it's so cool, and they're really, really beautiful to look at. So, yeah.
Incidentally, some cool things I learned co-hosting sometimes and definitely producing the Rock Art podcast is when you see animals in rock art, not all animals, because not all animals present this way, but the host of the Rock Art podcast has done a lot of work in the what's called the COSO range up in
California.
The Mojave sort of 395 area, Ridgecrest, that area. And COSO sheep are heavily represented in the COSO range. And anytime they show the sheep with their tails up, it means they're basically hot and heavy and ready to play, right?
They fertile,
yeah. And that just is a sign of fertility for the sheep. Mm-hmm. And when they show them with their tails down, it's a sign of non-fertility. And they're often represented with other signs of fertility. And if you just... you look at the whole picture of a rock art panel, you look at everything that's represented, and you can start to do some sorts of interpretations. But again, mm-hmm. it's really, really, really difficult because you're putting your modern biases and interpretations on these things, and you don't know what was in these people's heads. You don't know what they were literally smoking before they did these drawings. And
it's true.
You don't know.
Well, and there is evidence of various different mind altering, you know, drugs, and they might have been doing that before they do the paintings. So, it's so cool.
All right. 1 second, Michelle. Use the thing.
I would love to see this rock art. How do I get there?
Okay, so on the podcast...
with much difficulty.
I don't know if you saw this in your research, but on the podcast, and the last one we did was a few years ago with the person who ran the company, and I can't remember, it was called like... Baja Adventures or something like that. Yeah, but they literally had mule trips that would take 3 to 5 days because it took almost a whole day by mule to get down to this rock art.
Yeah,
and there was a little village actually down near there, and everything that was down at this village was brought by mule.
Yeah,
I mean there's
no roads, access in any other way other than mule.
Yeah, I mean they had refrigerators and stuff all run by solar power at this point, but they had all kinds of stuff down there and generators but all brought down by like pack mules, and it's like those big ass mules like you see at the Grand Canyon, not like these little tiny mules, right?
Yeah.
But that's how you get down there to see that. Now these days, because that company actually went out of business, there was not enough people doing it.
Yeah.
And
it was very expensive. That's the other thing. It's very difficult to get there, and then joining one of these expeditions was many thousands of dollars to do this. So it's just a lot.
Well, they covered everything. They'd pick you up in I don't know, the airport near
Tijuana or something.
Cabo.
Oh, down in Cabo. Yeah.
And then drive you up there, and they'd cover all your food and expenses and all that stuff. And
The pictures I've seen of these different places that you would get to go visit if you can finally get into this, you know, mountainous area, are stunning. Like, you really would want to just spend a week like wandering around
those mountains right there.
Checking out. No, they're way further south than that. Like
right
way further south. Keep going south. But yeah, they're just so stunning. And like, I feel like you could just, that one picture really got me of the guy like laying on his back, just observing. And like, I would want to just do that for hours. Cause the more you look at it, the more you see too. And like, there's animals and layers of animals, and then like humans on top of the animals. And there's some speculation that maybe that represents like dominance, like human dominance over the animals. And like, your brain just starts like spiraling while you're looking at these things. And I think that's the fun of archaeology for me. I would never like say that that's 100% what these things mean, but just like letting your brain just like like roll through the possibilities and dream and think about what they were thinking and dreaming about is just really fun. And it's this connection with people of the past that is hard to get in many ways today. So, yeah, I love that.
All right. Any other questions or questions about anything? Oh, did we find that? Do we know why it's called Puerto Peñasco?
Well, Puerto
aside
means
from being Rocky Point.
Point. Or no, Puerto means door, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Or port. Yeah. No, I don't know.
Any other, anything else? Anything about anything in archaeology from our attended audience? All right.
Yeah, now's your chance.
Yeah.
Throw us questions. We may or may not answer
them. Yeah, because
them.
After this, we won't talk to you ever again.
Yeah. Well, we are leaving
did
in
the,
a week.
Did the aliens have anything to do with the virgin sacrifices?
Oh, God.
Yes. No.
Microphone, coming your way.
Just for the recording.
Yeah.
Chris, I heard you mention aliens.
Indeed.
Has there been any findings in archaeology to substantiate claims
of aliens?
Of aliens.
So for Discord, has there been any findings in archaeology to substantiate claims of aliens? I'm going to go ahead and say no.
No.
Now, I have another comment on that. I'm going to say no because, primarily because people who think there are claims around that, they just underestimate what humanity can do, and they also underestimate what nature can do in some cases, like like the supposed oldest pyramid in the world, Gunung Padang, is basically a geological formation, but they think is some sort of alien formed pyramid, right? Or the 12-sided,
not alien, they were, this is a Graham Hancock thing where he's saying that it's from a previous civilization has been wiped off the earth, and
he's saying that, but he used to say aliens. So the previous civilization
nonsense.
The previous civilization may have alien influences, that's what it's, that was his previous deal, but
well,
now he's saying ancient
advanced
civilizations, but anyway, I think people just underestimate what humanity is capable of, to be honest with you. I mean, people are incredibly capable, they've done amazing things, and it's just because we don't understand how they could do it now or how they could have done it then doesn't mean they couldn't have done it. Right now, if you want to get into a deeper discussion of do aliens exist in this universe, of course they do. It's too big not to, but that's a completely different discussion.
That is indeed.
Yeah. could they ever get here? I don't know, probably not because of physics, but yeah.
Any other questions? All right. Cool. We're not going to talk about archaeology ever again. So.
All right. That's it. Lost your chance.
We're done.
Well, hey, thanks everybody for showing up. This was amazing. I didn't expect this kind of crowd. This is awesome.
Woo!
Let me pan around the crowd here because this is great. Woo! This is the biggest audience we've ever had.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. This is the only audience. That's what I'm saying. It clocks in at the biggest. Yeah. So. All right, I'm going to turn off the recording. Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.archpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at archpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.